ultimately technology gleaned from those crashes or that crash, depending on what you believe, and infused it into American industry. And we'll try and develop this story for you. The colonel is at a hotel where his telephone connection, unfortunately, is not very good. We're working on that. And so all of that coming up, hopefully, technical details on our side in a few moments. First of all, Dr. John B. Alexander, a little bit of background on him educationally, the University of Nebraska at Omaha, BGS in sociology 1971, Pepperdine University in 1975, an MA in education there, Walden University, a PhD in education in 1980, University of California, Los Angeles School of Engineering and Applied Science Engineering Management Program in 1990. Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Sloan School of Management, Executive Program in Management of Complex Organizations in 1991, and Harvard University, John F. Kennedy School of Government, Program for Senior Executives in National and International Security, 1993. Dr. Alexander has been an investigator of and a developer of non-lethal warfare systems. He is an absolutely fascinating person, and I trust that we have him on the line. Dr. Alexander?
Right.
Good. We've got you. You know what I think, Doctor? I think I should allow you to introduce Colonel Corso. Many people will not know who Colonel Corso is. They might know he's got a book called The Day After Roswell, and that might be about all they know. What would you say of Colonel Corso beyond that?
Well, I first met Colonel Corso about a year ago, and he came to us with a very unusual story, and that had to do, of course, with alien technology and the things that he has written about in his book. One of the things that struck us, of course, was his credentials, and of course, sometimes people fake them. So I spent a week in Washington checking out his background. And I went to the Pentagon, the National Archives, the Army Military History. I also went to the Army War College because a key person in all of the things that he talks about is a Lieutenant General Art Trudeau. And Trudeau, in the Army and military at all, was a legend. In fact, he was so well known that when the Army started doing their oral histories, he was one of the first eight people to be interviewed. Now, where this gets important is that during this interview, Phil Corso sat in every session with the general. So here it is, 20 years after they both retired, and they still remained very close friends. And one of the stories is he actually got his boss fired at one time, which is not usually career enhancing, but survived that and remained to be very close friends. So what I can say is when Phil says he was in the National Security Council, he was in this Foreign Technology Division in the Pentagon. It should not be confused with the thing at Wright-Patterson. This was a small Army thing. Basically, it was Phil, and a position that he held until he retired, looking at foreign materiel. And of course, he claims that this, some of it at least, was from the crash saucer.
So it would be fair to say the colonel is a former Army intelligence officer.
That's true.
All right.
He worked in with a heavy background in research and development.
Anyway, I've got a little bit more on the colonel, and I'd like to read it. Former intelligence officer, yes. Part of the Allied occupation forces in Rome from 1944 through 47. At the end of World War II, Operation Paperclip which brought German rocket scientists to the United States. During the Korean War, he served under General MacArthur, and from 1953 through 57 as a member of the National Security Council under President Eisenhower. It was in 1961 that Colonel Corso was appointed chief of the Army's Foreign Technology Division. It was then, on a certain fateful day, as the colonel tells it, that a file cabinet was wheeled into his office, the contents of which he was asked to examine by Trudeau. Corso was advised the contents were not, quote, run-of-the-mill foreign stuff, unquote, and was suggestively told to research the Roswell file before writing up his summary. Among the items in the cabinet, the colonel says he found a mysterious shoebox of tangled wires, a dull grayish silvery foil like swatch of cloth that he was unable to fold, bend over, tear, or wad up, but that bounded right back into its original shape without any crease. I wonder if any of you recall from the movie that exact description. Visually, you saw that material in the movie Roswell. And though it was a dramatic reenactment, that was obviously very much like is we have described here. And that is just the beginning. So there are many, many questions. All right, let's see if we can bring him on. Colonel, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we don't yet have Dr. Alexander back, but we definitely have you. And what I'd like you to do, if you'd be willing, is to add to what Dr. Alexander said, and tell us about your own background.
My background, I came in the Army 1940, when the war started, right after Pearl Harbor. And I was drafted, and I went to officer school, and I came out a second lieutenant, and they put me in an artillery outfit. And right after that, I got transferred to intelligence. And I was sent to England, got promoted to first lieutenant, and I joined British MI-19, and they sent me to Cambridge for 3 weeks, and I learned intelligence under them. And from there, I went to North Africa. I became an interrogator, prisoners of war, and worked with the British and with their commandos. Then I went to North Africa. And from North Africa, I participated in the landing at Salerno Harbor in Italy. Then I came up through Italy all the way to Cassino, and I was in the battles of Cassino. And from there, I landed on the beach at Anzio, and then went into Rome. And there, they made me Assistant Chief of Staff, G2 Intelligence, and Intelligence Security Chief of Rome Area Command. And I participated there in reestablishing law and order. I destroyed the Gestapo and SS nets. And from there, I came back to Fort Riley, Kansas.
So your career, to the point that you met the general, was a very honorable and fairly normal military career.
It was in combat at the time. We were fighting a war in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. And then I joined the general. I went to Korea after that. I participated in the Korean War, and I joined MacArthur's staff over there. And I came back, and when I came back to the States, I joined President Eisenhower as one of his military aides in the National Security Council at the White House. And there my career sort of changed. I was in the White House for 4 years. And from there I took command of a missile battalion, the Army's missile firing range at White Sands.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a combat missile battalion, and I had atomic warheads even, to Germany. And I stayed in command 18 months, and then I became Inspector General of 7th Army. And from there, I came back to the United States, and General Trudeau had reorganized research and development of the Army. And he sent for me, and I joined him as a special assistant and chief of the Foreign Technology Division.
So you had a very, very long military career before you met General Trudeau.
Yeah. Well, I met him when he was chief of Army Intelligence. And he sent me to the White House.
Okay, but at all this prior military service, Colonel,
yes.
You never laid hands on any sort of extraterrestrial
Oh,
anything, or even had a hint of it. Everything you did was
no,
very
I didn't. Not until I got to Fort Riley, Kansas.
Was very terrestrial and very normal and very heroic, I
And
might
very
add.
normal, yes, it was.
And that's where, I guess, with General Trudeau, in what year?
I joined him. First, I was in Army Intelligence, and he sent me to the White House. So I stayed there for 4 years. And then I came back to the United States in 1960, and I immediately joined him in research and development.
What did you do at the White House, Colonel?
I was on the policy. The Operations Coordinating Board was the policy guidance system. It investigated policy and made policy. And we were known as checked up on policy. And I actually chaired a lot of policy groups. And President Eisenhower, he, for example, assigned me a case was called the Volunteer Freedom Corps, where we're going to set up units in Germany, Polish and Czech and Romanians, flying a uniform with the uniform of their nation, and we were going to arm them. And he wanted to put this, and I worked on that and put it in. We were ready to put it in effect, and then he had his heart attack, and it went sort of downhill. CIA opposed it, and State Department opposed it. And I found out later that they used deceptive methods to oppose it.
All right. Dr. Alexander, you went to Washington and basically confirmed all of this background?
Yes, and probably a bit more. As I said, this is high-level intrigue, but it turns out that it's really true, and that is that General Trudeau, as the Chief of Staff Intelligence, Army Chief of Staff Intelligence, another, the highest intelligence guy in the Army, was fired. And
why? Or maybe I ought to say, for what?
there's high-level intrigue going on, and supposedly he had passed information to Adenauer, which the Dulles boys, who had CIA and state, were quite unhappy with.
Now, I was involved in that. And I can fill in the background if I guess John wants to do it.
Well, go ahead. You've got a better feel than I, Phil.
Yeah, okay. Well, what happened is I brought General Trudeau what we called the National Intelligence Estimates. These were the basis for U.S. policy, and they were made by CIA.
And, Colonel, the comment was made that you got your boss fired.
Well, possibly I caused it. I was a trained intelligence officer by the British, and so, and we had at the White House what we called National Intelligence Estimates. All were top secret. They were basis for U.S. policy. CIA made them up, and they were supposed to be compiled from hard intelligence.
This, Colonel, is the kind of thing that today you would see somebody walk in and put on the president's desk in the morning, that sort of report?
Well, it was sort of. But this was a basis for policy, and later would become national policy.
I might add, Art, these are very comprehensive reports. These are based on long-term projections. A number of people look at them, and they are... The intelligence community gets together and say, this is our best estimate.
So are these, in effect, not daily intelligence reports?
No, they're not daily.
But they summations that lead to a firm policy change for our government?
Most of the estimates that I uncovered were vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and Communist bloc. And I found out, since I could check intelligence from the military sources, I found out that they were not based on intelligence. It was mostly ideology, and just 2 years ago, CIA admitted this in newspaper articles. For example, I went to the general one day on the loss of Formosa, and I told him there was a national intelligence estimate on that. It was not important, so the general called CIA, called Alan Dulles, and he told him no such estimate existed. And I pulled the copy of it out of my briefcase and handed it to him, and I won't repeat what the general said. Now, these estimates, I found out that they were not based on hard intelligence. They were based on their thinking and ideology. And this was dangerous because most of them were apologetic to the Soviet Union. And we considered that a great danger. So when I laid these out to the general, and by the way, in 1962,
I testified for 2 days in front of a committee of Congress, a Senate Judiciary Committee, and this testimony is still rated top secret. It was on this subject. And Trudeau refused to comment on these overnight like they wanted, because they didn't want anybody to check on them. So they made up an excuse that he gave when Adenauer called him in Washington, and he briefed Adenauer on these cards. Well, I get in the act, and I send over to Germany, the CIC, the military, and I told him, get me information that Galen's outfit is penetrated. And they did. So Alan Dulles immediately took off for Turkey. And I still remember that's where he went. And two of my friends, former ambassador of Thailand, Max Bishop, and ambassador to South America and Mexico, Robert Hill, came with me. We went to see Senator Bridges, at the time chairman of the Armed Services Committee. Mm-hmm. And he was a tough old man. And he promised us that there wouldn't be another officer promoted in the Army until Trudeau was brought back and promoted. And he did. He got promoted to Lieutenant General. So this was the intrigue that went on. And, of course, this increased my animosity with CIA, because they didn't like an intelligence officer uncovering this.
I'm
sure. And remember, at the time, I was at the White House, which was considered above them. So I could call a few names back when I wanted to. And there was not much they could do about it. But this was the intrigue that where General Trudeau was relieved and then brought back bigger than ever. In fact, he took command of a corps and came back and reorganized research and development, which was in logistics, a secondary mission.
All right. Who was responsible, do you think, for bringing General Trudeau back?
Yes, because we were close until the old gentleman died. We were close friends.
No, I understand that. But what I'm asking, Colonel, is who
Strom
was...
Strom Thurmond. What was that? Who brought him back?
Yeah, who brought back General Trudeau?
Well, Secretary of the Army Brooker and a couple of generals, the chief of staff, who was at the time, I forget his name, but he was a friend of the generals, and they brought him back, and he became chief of research and development.
But it was because of Strom Thurmond and the support from the Hill.
Yes.
So Congress is integrally involved in this.
That's right, they were.
Right.
There were strong senators, Senator Eastland, Senator Dirksen, Senator McClellan, and Senator Thurmond and Nolan and people like that were involved on General Trudeau's side. And I know because I talked to everyone on personally.
And so they wanted him then as chief of R&D, and I take it despite all the political intrigue earlier, they knew him to be a patriot, they knew him to be a good man, and they trusted him, and I presume that's why they brought him back.
This was a general that took his helmet off with two stars. He was a division commander at Pork Chop Hill, and went up and fought with his men. He put on a sergeant's helmet.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a major general, division commander. That's the type of man he was. And also very religious. He went to retreats at Loyola, and one of the most brilliant men I ever knew in my life.
And so naturally, as he came back, so did you with him.
Well, I came back from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And when he found out I was back, he sent for me. And I walked in his office, and I saluted him, and he said, "You're bored, Phil?" I told him, "Yes, sir." He said, and the only order he ever gave me was, "Phil, watch things for me. The rest don't understand." And what he meant, the inside workings of the government.
Hmm.
So that was a story on the general.
Okay.
Because he challenged the estimates, which were a danger to us, because the Soviet Union at the time had said, we will bury you.
I recall.
Yeah. By the way, a defector told me that he was talking to Brezhnev in Germany and in Russia. There's a defector from Poland named Golonesky. And I asked him if he ever heard of Trudeau. He said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Brezhnev told me," and Brezhnev was premier then, he said that this is the most dangerous general in the U.S. Army. A defector actually told me that, Michael Golonesky.
And from what point of view do you think he meant that, the most dangerous man?
He meant that also as a fighting general, and because of his knowledge also in R&D and intelligence. He knew what they were up to.
All right, this is obviously going to get fairly complicated, and with all our phone troubles, we've made our way to the bottom of the hour. So everybody just relax for a few moments. Back now to respectively, Dr. John Alexander in Las Vegas and Colonel Philip Corso. Gentlemen, you're both back on the air again. All right, so now you went to work for General Trudeau, and this is where things begin to get interesting for you.
Yes.
At this point, again, you had never laid hands on anything extraterrestrial, probably hadn't seen a UFO or anything else. In other words, you were not any sort of ufologist or even interested.
No, I saw a body at Fort Raleigh, Kansas, but I put that out of my mind until I could corroborate information. I can intelligence and prove it. And later I had, there were some experiences that happened. My radars were picking up objects at White Sands when I commanded the range battalion, traveled 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour.
I guess that we better back up then. If you saw a body at Fort Raleigh, Texas, tell my audience...
It was in Kansas.
Tell my audience that story.
Well, what it was, I was appointed one night post-duty officer. Actually, lately there have been some criticisms. They said that the security was lax at Fort Riley if I did that. But I was the security officer that night, or the post-duty officer. And people know the Army know that when you're appointed post-duty officer, you're responsible for all the guards and security all that night on the post.
Why would anybody criticize that? I was in the Air Force, Colonel, and I remember that most all bases had an on-duty officer nighttime.
The critics didn't know this. They weren't in the Army. And really, that night, I was the security. And when I went down, one of my sergeants, Master Sergeant I knew well, was Sergeant of the Guard in the because we had horses in the area, the veterinarian area. And these five, I think it was five of them, yes. There was five boxes there that looked like caskets. And I went on in the room, because I was a security officer, I had to go inspect it. They told me it was sensitive cargo there. It come by truck.
Was it in transit, or was
it
that...
It was in transit.
It was in transit. All right,
I'll tell you how I knew that. Now, I went in, and I picked up the tarp, and I saw this body. Of course, I turned a little bit. At first, I thought it was a young, you know, baby or something. Then I got a little bit turned, like you do in combat, you know, something like that happens, your stomach gets upset, but you recover fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the sergeant, "Sergeant, get out of here, because since it's a raid, I don't want you in trouble. Go out to your post, and I'll be out in a second." I put the tarp back down, tarp. Now, this only lasted 10 or 15 seconds.
And what do you recall seeing? You say you saw a body, Colonel.
I saw an extraterrestrial, skinny arms, skinny legs, under 5 feet, had a fairly large head, not large, but compared to the body, it was large, and the eyes, they were slanted eyes, no nose, no mouth, no ears. It was floating in some liquid, and it was a gray color. And that's what I saw. And I immediately dismissed it. I figured, I don't know what it is until I can corroborate like an intelligence, maybe in the later. And later on, I was able to prove what it was.
Do you know what that liquid was?
No, I had no idea.
Uh-huh. And you say there were a total of five. Is that correct? Five caskets or five, if that's what you want to call
them? No, they were crates-like. But
crates.
They had a liquid in them. The thing was floating in some sort of liquid.
Okay, what date was this, as best you can recall?
It was Fort Raleigh, Kansas.
And the date?
1947. It was in July.
July.
Because I went to Fort Raleigh, Kansas. I was stationed out there with garrison duty. We had an intelligence aggressor force we were setting up for the military, and we were writing courses for intelligence. And I joined the Department of Non-Resident Instruction at Fort Raleigh, Kansas.
All right, since you're an eyewitness to this, and you're now... 82 years old, is that correct?
82.
It's very, very important that we be very clear about what you saw there. This is a very key point, I believe. The Air Force, as you well know, had a news conference and said, well, they were dummies. Now, is there any chance that what you saw, and in fact, as you know, the Air Force at their news conference showed these dummies that they dropped in later years, 1953, actually. But even if they had dropped them in 1947, they might have. Could you have been looking at a dummy, a non-being?
You know, I told people in late interviews that I will not criticize the Sister Service. And I won't, because I fought in Korea with them, and I have a lot of friends in the Air Force. But their superiors, I will criticize. There was no question in my mind what it was. I know the difference between a body like that I saw there and a dummy, or even a monkey, like some said. And then they've even come forth and said maybe it was Japanese in that balloon. I don't know where they get these stories or why they make them up. It's beyond comprehension to me. They don't have to do this.
So you saw a creature. There's no question about it.
Yes.
I take it, Colonel, you saw the Air Force's news conference, correct?
Yes.
And you saw the dummies that they showed that were dropped, correct?
Impossibility.
And that is not what was in that...
No chance.
No chance. All right. Do you know where these bodies were next headed?
Yes, I do know. When I came out, I asked the sergeants on the guard that night.
Right.
I asked, and they said, we talked to the drivers. It came from an air base in New Mexico. There was five trucks. Mm-hmm. And they were heading for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The boys, they had a driver and a co-driver, each truck. And the soldiers told the sergeants that. And they reported that back to me. It was on its way. And remember, in those days, about one of the only cross-country roads was Route 40. And
right.
They were coming through Route 40.
Right.
And they were heading for the Air Force Base in Ohio, Wright-Patterson. And the soldiers told them that's where they were going.
All right. Do you think that anybody else, the soldiers accompanying these caskets or whatever they were, also saw these beings?
Well, the sergeant did that I was with, that came in with me. And then I told him to get out because it was sensitive.
Where is that sergeant?
I can't answer that.
Okay, where is that sergeant now? Do you know?
It's been 50 years. I don't know. I wish I did know.
Okay.
Because he was a good boy, you know.
Well, he may be
listening. He was a master sergeant.
A master sergeant at that time.
Yes.
So he may or may not still be with us.
That part I can't answer. I don't know.
All right. So there you saw it. You saw this body, and then what?
Then I sort of forgot about it. And then when I became the missile commander at the range in New Mexico, I start picking up these objects traveling 3,000 and 4,000 miles an hour. And I start checking that, and our headquarters didn't want to be informed, so I didn't say much.
They didn't want to be informed?
No. I send one forward. See, on the Nike system, I had tapes. They looked like a lie detector thing. And that gave the entire firing sequence. So when one of these events happened, I would call the battery and said, send me the tapes. And this showed if it was true or not. And they actually were accurate. And later I discussed this with the radar people. And then when I went to Germany, I was picking up, every once in a while I'd pick up an object over there going 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour.
And nobody wanted to hear about it?
No, our headquarters, when I sent them the first report, they said, we're not interested, forget it. So I promptly forgot it, and I didn't report it any longer.
Dr. Alexander, does that make sense to you, or for that matter, Colonel, does it make sense to you? Then, certainly, we had not made any statement saying UFOs are no threat to national security, we're not interested. It would seem to me anything flying at 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour would have been of intense interest to the military then, or for that matter, now.
Not necessarily. And when you look at things like NORAD and places like that, if you don't believe that there is a threat that can go that fast, and you then say, and you're looking for threat or no threat,
right?
And if it doesn't exist, even if it goes that fast, it's not threatening you, it's no threat. And we were looking for every reason to discard targets, not to try and include them. Remember, computers were not like they are today. I mean, you've got more... power on your desktop today than NORAD had in those days.
That is true. And I suppose...
computers were the cam type. We had a needle that revolved around the cam. Then I got... those came from England. Then in my tour, before my tour was up, I had radars, and they were oil data pots. And that was quite an advancement in those days.
And it was, of course, primitive... throw out a bunch of RF and get a return type radar. There was no transponder usage or anything like that. So you were constantly looking at what really was in the air.
Yes. My radars, even in Germany, I had two batteries always on alert. and we were tracking these things. I had an acquisition radar, and then I had two target track radars. There was a pencil beam, which would lock on the aircraft and lock on the missile, one on the aircraft and one on the missile,
mm-hmm.
and the computer would bring them together. Now, when you fire Nikes, the missiles we had, we'd lock on the target, and then the one that's the missile, when it's fired, goes straight up in the air and then dives on the target. And it does not fire slant range. This was the Nike system that we had, which was the best that we had at the time.
All right. Dr. Alexander, as you went back to Washington again, you confirmed the colonel's service in these areas as best you could.
That is correct. No, he absolutely was the places that he said he was and when he was there and did what he says he did. By the way, Art, one other thing I think ought to be made that I think is important about Phil Corso is this is not the first time that he has come forward and told some pretty remarkable tales. In fact, in 92 or 93, talked about a secret war that had been going on. And this was done, reported in 2020, U.S. News and World Report, and to the U.S. Congress. And it was a war that had been going on, and Phil can tell you more about it because it's an important piece of why we responded the way we did. And except for those who had very special clearances, never knew that this was going on.
What secret war are we talking about, Doctor?
We were, for many, many years, we were probing the Soviet air defense. And we would send planes in and try to get them to turn on their electronics so that we could map their air defense system.
Sure.
It was a cat and mouse game, and every once in a while, the cat won. And we were losing air crews, and we knew, and Phil can tell you a lot about this, we had people down on the ground, captured, alive, and we didn't even ask for them back.
Sure. What year was that, John?
Oh, this went on for decades.
But with regard to the colonel's involvement?
Well, he was in the White House in the 50s when we had lost some of them.
Also, Art, we had a 100-inch camera, which was highly classified at the time, from northeast part of Korea, it could photograph alpha stock.
Really?
And this was highly classified at the time, and we were flying that over there. Now, Chris Wallace on primetime, he asked me one day when I was being interviewed on TV, Cold War, and I told him, Chris, I don't want to be ludicrous or it's not a joke. I'm very dead serious on this. I don't know of any Cold War. Every war I've been involved in was a hot war.
Mm.
And I told him, and people, boys were dying, they were shooting at each other, 30-millimeter shells and everything else coming at them.
Colonel, how many aircraft and air crew are you aware of that we lost during those kinds of operations?
I don't have the number, Art, but this went on for quite a few years. And it was a constant battle. And we lost a lot of men. In fact, I had a situation where when I testified in missing prisoners of war, a woman came out to me with her daughter, and they gave me the name of Lieutenant Colonel. I said, oh, yes, I remember him. He was a technical advisor on one of these airplanes with a 100-inch camera, and I used to receive the reports or the photos. The little girl got over and kissed me on the cheek. She said, finally, we don't know what our father did when he got killed, because the Pentagon told us he was joyriding. I told him he was not joyriding. He was a technical observer. Now, these things happened, you know. And Chris Wallace, and we walked in front of the White House. He took some photographs. He had his cameraman there. And he stopped, and he said, Colonel, now I understand. After all, you people are responsible for security of the nation. So, Chris, I'm glad to hear that you understand what we were doing.
Well, I understand that it had to be done. It is a little difficult for the American people to understand that when these air crews went down, even if they lived, they were basically abandoned?
Yes, they were. I testified in front of the House Committee and the Senate Committee on this problem.
What do you think happened to those men, Colonel?
I told President Eisenhower what happened to the, for example, at Pamlin John. I was on a truce delegation, and I was on the ground when the boys were being exchanged. A Korean colonel we had told him, civilians told him, there was 500 sick and wounded 10 miles from Pamlin John. I wrote this up Well, then our prisoners came through, and those boys told me that they saw those boys there. They were sick and wounded, pretty badly sick and pretty badly wounded. So I wrote up a presentation, and the chief delegate took it up at Panmunjom. The Chinese general broke a pencil in half when he heard this. Now, none of those boys came back, and they were all dead. They all were died. And this was 10 miles, yet I told the Senate committee for this, you know, they didn't ask me one question about it.
Well, maybe they didn't want to know.
Well, I think the answer to your question is that, particularly for the technical people, that after they fulfilled their usefulness, they were terminated.
Terminated. In other words, no doubt, the ones that ended up in enemy hands were tortured for whatever information could be gleaned and then disposed of.
Right. Well, they also took their identities. That was an intelligence aspect of what I discussed with President Eisenhower.
I wonder how people who have knowledge of this, Colonel, sleep at night. I mean, do you just rationalize it's war?
Well,
cold or hot, whatever you want to call it, it's war and there are casualties.
And after all, they threatened to bury us and they were a threat to us and we had no choice, just like the extraterrestrials. In the military, you think you always, just in case it's hostile, you're not going to be caught short.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing in extraterrestrials.
All right.
In case we're going to be ready.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about that. You saw a body in 1947. There's no question about what you saw. You know what you saw.
Yes.
It then went on to Wright Field in Patterson. And that really was the last contact of that sort you had until when?
Well, there was these planes were flying at Red Canyon there, and some things happened there. But then what confirmed it really in my mind, the collaboration, which is no question, we financed a laboratory at Walter Reed. Research and Development did.
Yes, sir.
They had autopsy reports. They had one, and they did autopsy reports, which I had in my file.
You had autopsy reports in your file?
Oh, yes. In fact, some of that's mentioned in the book. And I described the extraterrestrial. Actually, the way I described him in the book, that one of the reasons when we tried to make flying saucers and they all didn't work was the extraterrestrial himself, or it, whatever it was, they had no sex organs.
Uh-huh.
He was a clone and built specifically by some intelligence for space travel. He was actually a part of the flying saucer. He was the guide system.
So technically he was part of the craft.
Yes, he was part of the craft.
Uh-huh.
And he was the guidance system.
Colonel, if I may, how did they make that determination? In other words, all they had, or maybe I'm wrong, was dead bodies. Did they have any live?
Not that I know of.
Not that you know of.
But we know with electromagnetism, and remember, I had some von Braun scientists on my team. I discussed this with Hermann Oberth at Pedemunda. He was von Braun's boss, and he believed in space travel and dimensional travel even. And I discussed this with von Braun and my own German scientist. I had two on my team to investigate the line of atoms and metals.